I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to the LRB podcast, and I'm your host, Adam Schatz. My guest today is the Paris-based intellectual historian Enzo Traverso, who teaches at Cornell. Over the last three decades, Traverso, who grew up in Italy but writes in French, has published an extraordinary series of studies of the 20th century, including Marxism and the Jewish Question, The Origins of Nazi Violence, Blood and Fire, and the End of Jewish Modernity. He writes in a tradition of dissident Marxism with echoes of Gramsci, Isaac Deutscher, and above all, Walter Benjamin. But his work is also distinguished by its creative engagement with thinkers outside the Marxist tradition, notably Hannah Arendt, Carl Schmitt, and Edward Said. To read Enzo's writing is to experience the urgency, the still-burning presence of the past in our lives today. His latest book, Revolution and Intellectual History, published by Verso, is no exception. It's a wide-ranging, remarkably ambitious study of revolutionary passions, images, and ideas, ranging across the French and Haitian revolutions, the Russian and Chinese revolutions, the anti-colonial revolutions in the global South, and not least, the experiences of revolutionary exiles, outcasts, and pariahs, the men and women who continued in defeat and sometimes in despair to dream of a world transformed. Revolution is also the first book Enzo has written in English, and it's a work of elegance and admirable lucidity. Enzo, you were born in 1957 and raised in Piedmont. Your father was a communist, your mother was a left-wing Catholic. This was hardly a decade after the end of the Second World War. Italy, of course, had been profoundly shaped by the experience of fascism and then the partisan resistance. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences growing up in Italy in that period and how the notion of revolution, the subject of your new book, resonated during that period?
Yeah, I was born in Italy in 1957, and I grew up in a country which was politically dominated by the so-called two churches, the Communist Party on the one hand and the Christian Democracy on the other hand. So this depiction is, of course, a simplification, but it's not completely wrong. So these two political forces were not only the pillars of the institutions and of the political system, but they deeply shaped and pervaded the civil society and the culture. So retrospectively, I think that I can see a little bit better so the situation of that time. So the Communist Party and the Christian Democracy had rebuilt a civil society and created a democracy at the end of the Second World War, after more than 20 years of fascism. But when my generation came, the first generation who hadn't experienced the Second World War and resistance, these two political forces no longer appeared as actors of a social and political change, but rather as the walls of a kind of iron cage that paralyzed the country, not only politically, because the political system was fixed and frozen. We were in the time of the Cold War, but also culturally speaking. And I think that at that time it was called La Nuova Sinistra, the new left, or the extra-parliamentary left, the revolutionary left, was an attempt to destroy the walls of this iron cage. So I think it's important to say that the extra-parliamentary left failed politically, because our project was nothing less than making a revolution in Italy. And a revolution in Italy didn't take place. And we paid a very high price for this failure, because the consequences were terrorism, were depolitization of society in the 80s. And finally, I think the outcome was neoliberalism, an almost new form of neoliberalism without any alternative. But culturally speaking, we won, because many social conquests, many rights for minorities, so the struggles of rebellious movements of feminism. So these changed society, and these pushed these two churches, so a secular church is the Communist Party, and another church which was organically related with so the Catholic religion, so were compelled to abandon many cultural codes that they had embodied in for decades.
You say that, you know, that your aim is to rehabilitate the concept of revolution as an interpretive key to modern history against a school that began to really gain ground after 1989, and which has argued that, you know, changing the world always means building totalitarianism. And I think you're referring to historians like François Furet. Yet you hardly deny the human costs of revolution and the injustices that it can generate in correcting injustice. Your subject is revolution for better or worse. So what is it about revolution that you think deserves rehabilitation? Is it the dream and aspiration, the history of collective struggle, or the concrete achievement?
Well, I don't think that it's so productive to sketch a kind of typology of good or bad revolutions. My worry and my purpose was to rehabilitate the concept of revolution as a key to interpret modernity. And I thought that this was important because with the turn of the century and with the end of the Cold War, the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, I think that a certain view of the past appeared in which the 20th century is perceived as the age of total wars, genocides, and the age of violence. And revolution was to
a part of that history.
Large extent,
it was very much a part of that history.
It was engulfed in this view of the 20th century as the age of violence. I tried to show that the 20th century was also the history of revolutions, and it was also the history of extraordinary hopes and aspirations, and it was also the age of utopias, and the age of struggles, collective struggles for changing the world.
Emancipation and freedom. You know, your book actually begins earlier than the 20th century. It begins in the Louvre, with a discussion of Théodore Géricault's 1819 painting, The Raft of Medusa, and an allegory of what you call the shipwreck of revolution. What is it about that painting that spoke to you so powerfully? Why did you begin the book with The Raft of Medusa?
So The Raft of Medusa is one of the most important paintings of Romantic art from the age of Restoration, and it describes a shipwreck with this raft of outcasts, of survivors of this shipwreck who are waiting for salvage. So I think that all artworks, and particularly all masterpieces, change their meaning with time. So I agree with art historians and art critics who think that images look at us, are not passive objects which can be admired and contemplated. And at any time, works of art can transmit new messages and new meanings. And looking at this painting at the end of the 20th century or today, inevitably, in my view, interrogates or raises questions about the shipwreck of socialist revolutions.
And one of the things that we notice looking at this painting today is the black man, who is the sort of towering figure in the painting, waving a red rag or a handkerchief like a flag. And this is less than 20 years after the Haitian Revolution.
Yeah, this figure of a black man agitating this flag, this red flag in this painting, in a time in which red flag didn't exist yet, because the red flag will appear later as symbols of rebellion or of the left. But this black man can be interpreted as both hidden reference to the Haitian Revolution, so the first emancipatory revolution against slavery, and also the announcement of the revolutions of the 19th century, but also for us who watch this painting today, so the announcement of the colonial revolutions of the 20th century. So this painting is extremely rich and is a condensation of meanings.
The main inspirations behind your approach to revolution are Karl Marx and Walter Benjamin, but as you point out, they have very different conceptions of how revolution relates to historical time. Marx said that revolutions can't draw their poetry from the past. Benjamin saw revolutions as a kind of redemption for the suffering of oppressed ancestors.
Yeah, I think that Benjamin consciously criticized Marx and changed the conventional concept of revolution and so this is the reason for which I decided to start my book with a chapter on revolutions as locomotives of history. This is a famous Marxist metaphor of revolution, and I think that this is more than a metaphor, because it's a metaphor that summarizes, synthesizes a worldview, a certain view of history, a certain
view of history is linear and teleological, and yet,
of course.
And yet even Marx didn't see revolutions as emerging in any linear or teleological fashion, right? Revolutions were eruptions.
Yeah. I point out that there is a tension in Marx's work between his philosophy of history, which is not in all his writings, but in most of his canonical works, is shaped by a certain teleological vision of history, history as a linear march towards progress, and also he theorized revolution as a kind of outcome of this contrast, conflict between the development of productive forces and the relations of production. So he thought revolutions as the outcome of a certain deterministic causality. And so this view of revolutions as the locomotives of history obviously implies a certain teleological vision of history, because trains and locomotives run along railways, and we know the destination of these trains. So Benjamin, during the Second World War, at the beginning of the Second World War, in cataclysmic context, in which the idea of progress was radically put into question, he reversed this image of revolution and said revolutions are not the locomotives of history, but rather the emergency brake allowing us to stop this race of the train towards a catastrophe. So I think that the history of revolutions is a permanent swinging between these two poles. Revolutions as a quite naive and generous race towards the future, and revolutions as attempts at stop incumbent catastrophe.
Now, your book has an unusual structure. It touches on a variety of revolutionary moments from 1789 to the mid-20th century, but it's not chronological. Rather, it's organized around what Benjamin called dialectical images. You define dialectical images as lamps that cast a light over the past. They include locomotive trains, which you just mentioned, bodies, statues, flags, posters, individual lives. And you argue that these dialectical images are important not just to how we see revolutions, but to how they're imagined and made by participants themselves.
Yeah, I tried to work with a methodological reference, which was so Benjamin's Passagenwerk, so his book on
The Paris Arcades.
The Paris Arcades, so, which is a constellation of dialectical images or thought images in his definition, Denkbilder. So images as both historical sources, as evidences in the classical meaning of the word, so evidences with which historians work, evidences that fill the historian workshop, but at the same time, images as visualized concepts, or as figures allowing us to visualize concepts. Images as condensation of meanings and as tools which can help scholars to interpret and to understand the past, because our analytical categories can be fixed into something visible, so that can be visualized. And I thought that this way of working, this procedure, could be more interesting rather than a quite conventional chronological approach to revolutions, because my purpose wasn't to describe the history of revolutions, which is known, very well known, and is a topic to which very good books have already been devoted. But my purpose was to capture something that belongs to the revolutionary imagination, revolutionary experience, and to revolutionary ideas.
I mean, you also write about how revolutions were imagined by their adversaries and enemies. There's a fascinating chapter on the body, how the bodies of the oppressed were seen. And you write that the enemies of revolution have always animalized the oppressed. You quote an especially grisly passage comparing the Bolshevik Revolution to, quote, an animal form of barbarism embodied by swarms of typhus-bearing vermin or troops of ferocious baboons amid the ruins of cities and the corpses of their victims. The writer is not Hitler. The writer is not Goebbels. It's Winston Churchill, writing in 1920.
Yeah. So these counter-revolutionary literature is extremely rich, picturesque when it's read posteriorly. So retrospectively, I would say that I'm literally fascinated by the power of these counter-revolutionary imagination, from Joseph de Maistre to Carl Schmitt. And Churchill plays a distinguished role in this gallery of counter-revolutionary thinkers. So this mixture of animalization of political rebellion, in which animals are very often assimilated to inferior, lower races. So this mixture of animal allegories, of racism, class racism, lower classes assimilated to savages, animals, and lower classes. And so this mixture of colonialism and anti-Semitism is extremely powerful.
I mean, this was the subject of your Origins of Nazi Violence, and I think you depicted very vividly how the language of racialization and animalization within Nazism was not that far from what one could observe in the discourse of other forms of Western imperialism. I mean, it was given a biological, scientific foundation, of course, but the distance from Churchill's remark to Nazism is not that far here.
No, I think that it could be, and I did, so very easy to find correspondences. So almost mechanical analogies between a reactionary discourse that appeared in France after the Paris Commune, the communards depicted as beasts. So the language, the lexicon of counter-revolution in Central Europe at the end of the First World War, and the way in which Bolshevism was depicted by conservative literature, and finally the Nazi literature, which so accomplished this larger trajectory of counter-revolutionary literature.
We tend to think of the French Revolution and its successors, which replaced systems based on monarchical rule, religious authority, and so on, as expressions of a secular enlightenment. But you argue that what we see, in fact, is a transfer of sacredness from religion and tradition to secular values, from the worship of God, the saints, the church, and the king, to the worship of secular values like freedom, equality, humanity, nation, and reason. To illustrate this point, you quote a figure who's not at all a person of the left, the Nazi jurist Carl Schmitt, who said that all significant concepts of the modern theory of the state are secularized theological concepts. What does that mean?
I think that Carl Schmitt understood a very significant feature of modern politics in general, and also indirectly, because this wasn't his purpose when he wrote this sentence in his political theology, but also in order to understand the trajectory of certain revolutionary movements. And from this point of view, I think that Carl Schmitt's diagnostic is quite close to Ernst Bloch's interpretation of utopian imagination in history. If we have to say in a word, which is the relationship between religion and revolution, I would say that it's a conflicting relationship, because modern revolutions always perceive the religion as an ideology of the power, as institution of the established order, and also as a form of alienation and of domination. So revolutions usually, with very few exceptions, Iran, for instance, in 1979, but usually revolutions are directed against religion. And sometimes in a very radical and violent way. So think of the Spanish Civil War and the anarchist violence against the church and all symbols of
against,
religion.
Against institutional religion, but you are suggesting that there is this transfer of the sacred, that there is something that revolutions do speak to certain longings and fantasies that religion had spoken to previously.
Yeah, this is the idea of Ernst Bloch, who stressed that modern socialism and communism secularized hopes, aspirations, desires, which historically had been embodied by religions. And so Marx and Engels themselves established a kind of continuity between the peasant war in Germany at the time in the 16th century and modern class struggle. So from this point of view, I think that Carl Schmitt's sentence is perfectly valuable and can be fruitfully applied. And the 20th century is also an age of strange hybrid forms between secularism and religion. There are some heretical thinkers, revolutionary thinkers, like Benjamin, for instance, who tried to find a kind of synthesis between secular Marxism and Jewish messianism, for instance. And this is the reason for which they were misunderstood for during their life and for many years after. So when Walter Benjamin showed his famous thesis on the concept of history to his friends, so Brecht reacted saying, so this is a wonderful revolutionary document, but I don't understand why it is written in this strange and bizarre messianic language. And Scholem said exactly the opposite. So this is a wonderful theological document, but I don't understand why you write with these ununderstandable references to Marxism and to class struggle. So Benjamin's attitude was very peculiar and quite irreceivable at that time. But nonetheless, so these hybrid forms of conflation or of entanglement between religion and revolution were extremely important. Think of this category, these forged by Isaac Deutscher, of the non-Jewish Jews. The non-Jewish Jews, like Marx or Rosa Luxemburg or Trotsky, or he said also Freud, so who rejected Judaism as a form of obscurantism, as vestige of the past. So like any kind of religion, a form of alienation, an ideology of oppression, and they wished to abandon this past, which was their own background, but at the same time they claimed their own Jewishness, because they acted and lived surrounded by anti-Semitism in a cultural and political context in which much they couldn't avoid their Jewish roots. And this created this fascinating figure of the non-Jewish Jew. But so we could extend this example, speaking about the theology of liberation in Latin America, for instance, or even in Europe, in Western Europe, in Italy, for instance, the conflicting but at the same time fruitful relationships between religious currents within social Catholicism and secular communism.
But you also talk about some of the more troubling aspects of this religious or sacred strain within revolution. I'm thinking, for example, of the idea of social regeneration through violence, or the purging of enemies, the creation of the so-called new man, and the rise of communist parties that, as Edgar Morin writes, and you quote him, were as strict, authoritarian, and as secretive as the Catholic Church. You also mention Trotsky's fascination with eugenics at one point. And it just made me think that, you know, while revolutions are a break in the continuum of history, they interrupt history, you know, to paraphrase Benjamin, but they're also very much products of specific histories, and so shaped and limited by them. And so, you know, what you describe is not just revolutions that display this, you know, enormous human creativity, but also the tragic limitations they express.
Well, I distinguish between different dimensions of revolution. Revolution as a concept, as an abstract category. So revolution is usually split between liberating emancipatory moment, which is ephemeral, and which is the moment which happens.
The joy in the street moment, the moment creation.
The moment in which the old order falls apart and is destroyed, and in which the dominated, the oppressed, the lower classes suddenly discover their strength, suddenly become historical subjects and achieve this consciousness that they are able to change the society and history. This is a kind of magical moment. I call it the Eisensteinian moment of revolution. But so there is another dimension of revolution, which is the difficult suffering process of building of a new order, a new social and political order, when revolutions are not defeated, as it occurs in most cases.
This is the LRB podcast. If you enjoy listening to it, you'll probably enjoy reading the London Review of Books. To subscribe from just £1 per issue, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link below.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the more interesting figures you write about, who very much illustrates the point that you've just made, is Alexandra Kollontai, this Soviet radical who exemplified the contradictions between sexual liberationism and hedonism on the one hand, and the and asceticism and Puritanism on the other. I mean, she was an advocate of red love and imagined this radical recasting of familial and erotic relations, but her vision of liberation ended up losing out to a puritanical strain in Soviet communism.
Yeah, so this is exactly the illustration of this divide I mentioned between a revolution as an emancipatory moment and a revolution as the process of building of a new political regime. And Kollontai theorized the sexual revolution in 1917, so in a time in which most countries in Western world didn't give the right of vote to the women. And revolution as the process of building of a new regime with an ideology and with the restoration also of old forms of life. And from this point of view, so the reference to religion and to the reference to socialism or communism as a secular religion becomes pertinent, because a secular religion with its own institutions, with its own hierarchy, with its ideology, with its rituals, liturgies, customs, and these this is a very significant and large part of the history of revolutions viewed as a global process.
I want to go back to a point that you were making earlier about the people Isaac Deutscher called non-Jewish Jews. In your chapter on the revolutionary intellectual 1848 to 1945, you return to a theme that you explored in your first book, Marxism and the Jewish Question, namely the mutual attraction of Jews and revolution in Eastern and Central Europe. Jews, you point out, represented between a fourth and a third of the Central Committee of both the Menshevik and Bolshevik parties in 1917. And Jews continued through much of the first half of the 20th century to be disproportionately represented in left-wing and revolutionary movements. Why do you think revolutions attracted so many Jews?
Well, this is a fascinating chapter in the history of both modern revolutions, in the history of Marxism, and in the history of the Jews themselves, of course. I think that these kind of elective affinity, speaking with Goethe and with Michael Loew, between the Jews and revolution, and in this case between the end of the 19th century and the mid and the Second World War, was the product of historical circumstances. So I don't think that we could explain that through the peculiarities of Judaism as a religion, because Jewish messianism is susceptible to merge with revolutionary ideas and secular revolutionary ideologies, as well as Christianity and Christian millenarism, or even in certain parts of the world, Indonesia, for instance, Islam and revolution. So in Europe, and particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, between the end of the 19th century and the Second World War, the Jews, and particularly Jewish intellectuals, were exposed to all the contradictions and tensions of their time. And they were pushed by their own social conditions, and they were pushed to embrace avant-garde currents and they were pushed towards all kind of anti-conformistic political currents. And they almost naturally became the leaders of many revolutionary movements.
And I suppose also Marxism represented an ideal of universal emancipation, and therefore emancipation from their own communities as well. What I mean, from anti-Semitism, but also from the confines of the Jewish community.
Yeah, in this sense, I spoke of, so they embodied the contradictions of their time. And so they rejected Judaism. On the one hand, they no longer depicted themselves as Jews in a national or religious meaning of the word. At the same time, they were, in both the Central and Eastern Europe, they were rejected by nationalisms which were anti-Semitic. Marxism was a kind of universalism that allowed them to overcome this tension between a rejected and abandoned Judaism and the rejection by nationalism.
And yet, interestingly, Enzo, in your first book, you also argued that the Jewish question revealed the blindness of the Marxist tradition to the significance of both religion and nation in the modern world. And you also went on to say that the Jewish question revealed classical Marxism's blindness to other forms of domination not directly related to the class structure of society, such as national, race, and gender oppression. So Marxism, on the one hand, was salvation to the left-wing Jews who embraced it, and yet at the same time, Marxism represented a real blind spot with respect to Jewish identity, also with respect to colonialism.
Yeah, exactly, because Marxism offered this form of universalism and internationalism that became their own identity. And many intellectuals I study in my book were people who believed in world revolution, and world revolution had become their identity and their home. This is perfectly true. At the same time, Marxism, and from this point of view, Marxism was the inheritor of what is, so roughly speaking, called radical enlightenment. Marxism inherited from the Enlightenment a criticism of religion, which tended to analyze anti-Semitism as a kind of an archaic, a vestige of the past, as an archaism.
A surviving atavistic prejudice that would one day simply vanish.
Yeah.
And couldn't really see how it could be weaponized as a modern ideology under Nazism.
A legacy of a pre-modern age. So they were absolutely unable to understand that anti-Semitism was a central feature of a reactionary modernism, of an ideology that didn't, like fascism or national socialism in particular, which didn't look at the past, but rather defended an utopian vision of the future. And anti-Semitism was a key of reactionary modernism.
You know, revolution is also striking for being perhaps the least Eurocentric of your books. In The Origins of Nazi Violence, you discuss the relationship of imperialism and colonization to the Jewish genocide, but here you go even further in decentering Europe. You include figures like the Indian communist, Manabendra Nath Roy, Jose Rizal in the Philippines, Ho Chi Minh, Mao, the Peruvian Marxist, Jose Carlos Mariátegui, C.L.R. James, Franz Fanon. Anti-colonial revolutionaries from what today is called the Global South also affected another important shift in the revolutionary imagination that you describe, a more positive appraisal of the role of the peasantry in political change.
Sure. But this change was theorized by Mao in particular, and so this change was internalized by Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, and was posteriorly both theorized and practiced by the guerrilla movement in Latin America. So this change was very significant because it broke with one of the premises of classical Marxism, according to which peasantry was a conservative class.
A sack of potatoes.
Yeah. So because Marx's view of the peasantry was deeply shaped by the experience of French Bonapartism, and according to Marx, French peasantry was one of the social bases of Bonapartism. But Marx himself started viewing peasantry with a different lens at the end of his life, when he took contact with the Russian translators of Capital, who had been involved in the populist movement in Russia. And the populist movement, which had a peasant basis and an intellectual leadership. So some premises existed for this change, which was formalized with the colonial revolutions of the 20th century.
Now, you know, you quote Edgar Morin as saying that the communist experience represented a monstrous step of a gigantic adventure to change the world. I'm wondering, how do we disentangle what was noble about it from the monstrosity of the purges, collectivization, the gulag, to say nothing of the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, the genocide in Cambodia? My question really is, did the left abandon revolution in part because of the excesses, the oppression, the carnage that the revolutionary project left behind? Is that why we end up with the, you know, the critique of people like Foucault or Deleuze of the kind of grand revolutionary project?
This is a question that runs throughout my book. And my answer is that these radically different and intimately opposed dimensions of communism belong to the history of revolutions and are not separable. Hmm. And this is the point. So I, for many years when I was young, I lived with this comfortable illusion that we could radically separate communism as revolution from communism as a political regime, Leninism as revolution and Stalinism as counter-revolution. And finally, I understood, I think I have understood, that this binary logic doesn't work.
I mean, in a sense, it sounds as though you are coming to terms with the limitations of a certain kind of sectarian Marxism, right? A sectarian Trotskyism, for which Stalinism was always the perversion of the Leninist project, but really it has to be understood in some way in relation to it.
Sure, but so this is one of the reasons for which my book is not a nostalgic book. It is not a book that tries to idealize revolution or to build a kind of idea of a romantic or beautiful ideal type. So revolutions are at the same time moments of emancipation, without which what humanity achieved in modernity wouldn't be understandable. And revolutions are at the same time moments of domination, oppression, of destruction of all these emancipatory hopes and practices. So I Stalinism can be, of course, considered as a counter-revolution insofar as it destroyed many aspirations and hopes and many values affirmed by the Russian Revolution in 1917. But Stalinism wasn't a counter-revolution because the purpose of Stalin wasn't to restore capitalism or to come back to the old regime. Stalin had a true aspiration to build a new society, and he did. So Stalinist Russia was an extremely authoritarian and bureaucratic and horrific and totalitarian project of modernization.
You know, you say at some point that the new anti-capitalist movements of our own times don't resonate with any of the left traditions of the past. You say they lack a genealogy and reveal greater affinities with anarchism. Being orphans, they must reinvent themselves. Are they orphans, or do they just have different parents?
I think they are orphans. They are orphans because the anarchist and libertarian features which one can detect in these new movements don't mean conscious continuity with the anarchism of the 19th or 20th century. I think that these new movements are really trying to invent something new, and this is their strength. I think that they already achieved many important, significant results in this process, but I don't think that a new project for the 21st century could be elaborated, invented, and practiced without working through the past, without elaborating a memory of a defeat. And this memory meant, in the largest sense of the word, this memory also implies, also supposes to include communism and Stalinism in this dialectic of enlightenment. Because the dialectic of enlightenment is a concept that was forged by the Frankfurt School, Adorno,
in relation to fascism.
In relation to fascism. But so their idea was that fascism was not a throwback of civilization into a pre-modern form of barbarism. Fascism was an outcome of civilization itself. And the idea of the dialectic of enlightenment means that industrial, technological, and scientific development and progress can correspond with human and social regression. And I think that this dialectic of enlightenment works also with communism and Stalinism. The difference is that, in fascism, the dialectical of enlightenment for fascism means fascism as reactionary modernism, fascism as an hybrid symbiosis between the values inherited from anti-enlightenment, the rejection of universalism, of humanism, of the French Revolution, and so on, and a cult of technology, of modernity, of industry, of science, etc. The case of communism is different because under Stalin, the dialectic of enlightenment is the illustration of the outcomes of an authoritarian interpretation of enlightenment itself. So the Gulag, the collectivization of agriculture in Soviet Russia, or Chernobyl cannot be dissociated from a certain conception, a certain view of socialism as development of productive forces.
Productivism.
Yeah, and as a development of technology, as the advance of civilization. Well, maybe this concept of dialectic of enlightenment, which in the Soviet Union too, means this combination between technical industrial progress and social regression, but could be, I think, related to Ernst Bloch's concept of cold utopias. So a project for the future, which is an authoritarian utopia, the utopia of an egalitarian society, but not created by self-management, self-emancipated human beings, but created, planned, and built by authoritarian power.
Didn't Gramsci call that a passive revolution?
Yeah, but Gramsci called passive revolutions some revolutions from above. And right. From this point of view, maybe Stalinism could be included in this category. So Stalinism as a revolution from above in a pacified and stabilized Russia, different from a revolution from below, which was 1970.
I mean, one of the great strengths of your book, Enzo, is that it is at the same time a celebration or a kind of admiring commemoration of the revolutionary passion and of the revolutionary efforts of the past, and at the same time, to some extent, a cautionary tale. And I wondered, what would you like the contemporary left-wing movements, which you described as orphans of history, what would you like them to take away from this book about movements of which, in many cases, they're unaware?
Maybe not in this book. In my previous book, Left-Wing Melancholia, I tried to analyze this lack of memory in these new anti-capitalist alternative movements. And I think that this lack of memory is not a peculiar weakness of this movement, is a general feature of our...
of the postmodern regime, condition?
Yeah, regime of historicity, more than postmodern condition, I would say, of our regime of historicity, which some scholars call the presentism. So a time in which both past and future are condensed and compressed into the present. And this lack of memory on the one hand, and this incapacity to project themselves into the future on the other hand, is a limitation not only of the new left-wing movements, is also a limitation of the right-wing movements. If you look at this constellation of right-wing movements, radical rights that appeared everywhere in the last decade, so they are looking at the past much more than projecting themselves towards the future. So this paralysis in utopian imagination, this lack of prognostic projection is the most significant handicap of the left today. The walls of this presentist regime of historicity will be broken, I think that we will know new forms of radicality, of rebellion, like in the 60s or the 70s.
In your book, Where Have the Intellectuals Gone? You write, the world cannot live without utopias, and it will invent new ones. What seems certain to me is that there will no longer be revolutions made in the name of communism, or at least not the communism of the 20th century. Communism was engendered by an age of wars, and it conceived of revolution on the basis of a military paradigm, and that age is over. One can formulate the hypothesis that future revolutions will not be communist in the manner of the 20th century, but that they will be made for a common good that has to be rescued from commercial reification. Revolutions arise from social and political crises without resulting from a law of history or any deterministic causality. They are invented, and their form is always uncertain. So that's where we are right now, isn't it, Enzo? We're waiting to see what new kinds of revolutions people imagine and invent, because in your telling, at least, revolution, the idea of a utopia, is a human need.
Yeah, but maybe one of the reasons for which the new alternative and left-wing movements are unable to critically elaborate the legacy of the past and the legacy of both ideology and political experiences of the past is that these new movements are facing the threat of a world going towards an ecological catastrophe. We have to think a new civilization, new forms of consumption of energetic sources for our economies. But all revolutions of the past faced completely different problems. For the Chinese Revolution, for the Russian Revolution, in Vietnam, in Cuba, the problem of the development of productive forces was a priority, was a fundamental problem. These revolutions, in many cases, took place in countries destroyed by wars, in countries whose economies were completely destroyed, and they had to reconstruct and to develop. And the development meant many things. In my chapter on revolutionary bodies, I try to show how Kollontai's thesis on sexual revolutions merged with essential needs, which were productivized and disciplined bodies in order to reconstruct destroyed economies. So from this point of view, the experience of the Russian or the Chinese revolution or the Cuban revolution is ununderstandable for the new generations on the global world. This is the dialectic of 21st century memory and utopias.
We've been talking with Enzo Traverso, the author of Revolution, an Intellectual History, published by Verso. Enzo, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Adam.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.